Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we hope you had a Merry Christmas. So we didn't say that at the end of our last episode, but we recorded so far before Christmas. It wasn't even on my mind. And like, I know we had an episode technically like in the last week or so, but it feels like we haven't recorded in 2 weeks.
No, it really hasn't. It's been kind of like a weird holiday for us because of the fact that we recorded before Christmas and we're now recording not at our usual time. Like, both times were not usual times for us.
Yeah.
And in between, I got sick. It was not fun. I'm still recovering from it.
You've had a... We were both on vacation. I think yours was definitely rougher than mine. You got sick. Ripley says she's sorry. You lost the internet, right?
Yeah. I lost internet for like a day. Like, and guys, this is why I have I have physical media.
When you texted me that, I was like, look, it always sucks to lose internet, but for all the people I know to lose internet, like two people that I'm like, they'll be okay as long as their power's on. You and Scott.
Yeah, because we literally have, like, I literally have, like, I'm not trying, this is not a humble brag, this isn't even a brag, this is more of like a, you should, like, you'll now know my addiction. I have, like, recently, Carrie Coon has, like, outed her husband, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, Terry Letts. He wrote Bug, he wrote Osage County, which is a film that I really love and I really relate to now. I've never seen the play, I really do want to see it. Talking about like families and shit, but Tracy Letts she outed him by telling the world that he has over 10,000 Blu-rays. I'm hovering around 5 or 6.
Yeah,
I'm not Tracy Letts level addiction or Scott, all out Scott. I think he said that he's hovering around physical discs probably like 7 or 8,000. Which is wild, but yeah, I mean, it's just like, yeah, I just went into my physical media and just went into it. But man, like because we were in the midst of a show that we're going to be talking about today, two shows that we're going to be talking about today, we were going back and forth between them. What If and Shrinking, man, that was a hard punch to the face, especially when you're on vacation and you're like, fuck it, let's do this. So yeah, but
they, you're like, nope, no streaming for you.
Exactly.
So we both did get to go see movies at Christmas time. You did not get to see Sonic 3, unfortunately.
My nephews made me promise that I'd go see it with him, and
I completely understand.
I'm not gonna mess that up, dude. Like, because like they were like, the fever at which they like, this is like their Star Wars or their fucking Fast.
It really is, man. Like, we'll start with that since we're so. Okay. I did see Sonic 3. I went with my nephew Jace, and my little brother, and we had an absolute blast.
I love to hear.
I think it's. It's weird this, so I don't think I had as much fun as I did with Sonic 2, or maybe or even Sonic 1, but I think Sonic 1 was a different level of like, I don't think this is going to be good, and sitting down in the theater and being like, I can't believe I'm enjoying this. Sonic 2 was more of like, I can't believe they were able to do this twice. This, I think, is the best movie.
That makes sense. I mean, especially with, I mean, you've got some tropes in this sequel that I'm really curious about. The first of which is, like, you have Jim Carrey playing two roles, which is
Here's the thing. If you didn't know that was Jim Carrey, you 100% you would not know it's Jim Carrey.
Wow. Okay. You see, that's what I like to hear. Like, I hoped it was going to be a performance and not like a kind of blah, 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 or two Jim Carreys. Let's do it a wacky.
I mean, there is like a definite like part of that. And I wish, without really getting into spoilers, I wish his version of he's playing his own grandfather. I think they kind of give that away in the trailer. Like, there's that whole like weird Santa Claus scene, which is part of a montage that is absolutely hysterical. But he's like grandpapa, and so
yes,
there is a level of goofiness to that character that I honestly wish didn't exist. I wish that character were more grounded, and it would make Insane Dr. Robotnik like more off the wall. He would seem more off the wall rather than like, oh, his whole family is just insane. So I kind of hate that, but Shadow is fantastic. It never stops being fun watching him just beat the hell out of the rest of the crew.
Yeah. I mean, how is, like, because of the fact that, like, you know, we know that Knuckles is the most arrogant of them, how is it that, like, what is, like, Knuckles' like kind of story arc because of the fact that Shadow is, like, the ultimate, like, is the ultimate hedgehog and just kind of can beat anybody?
It's, there's moments of him, like, coming to terms with, like, not being the most badass of all the characters. But we kind of got a more grounded version of Knuckles when we got the Knuckles show, which we did talk about. So you got a little more, like, they took a little of that edge off already, which if you watch the show, kind of does help going from, like, oh, Knuckles is all bravado and, like, can back it up with his fist to, like, him not immediately just charging in head first and trying to punch people. We get to see kind of a different side of Sonic, which is interesting. They revisit his past a little bit. It's a really, really fun time. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but they've already announced Sonic 4.
They have. I was hoping with that announcement they would announce as Knuckles 2, because, like, I went through this weekend, like, on the Lolo, rewatched the first two Sonics and Knuckles, and I can honestly say that, like, Knuckles is not just my favorite character, but, like, of the things that they produced, I feel like the Knuckles show was, like, kind of, like, it's kind of brilliant. And it's, like my favorite thing. It's not the best of the Sonic universe. I mean, that's two, just because it does, like, it does double down. Like you said, like, it's one thing to have a movie surprise you, which it did. Like, the first one really did surprise me with how charming it was. I mean, I think we actually talked about it, and we talked about specifically James Marsden doing the heavy lifting in that one. I mean, he's just a brilliant comedian. Like, I'm glad that he has had this second life. I mean, like, since then he's become like a true comedic force, right? Like, but I mean, a weirdo, like, not like oh yeah, you're funny. It's like he does the weirdest fucking things, but they work. Like, I mean, I'm thinking of the Jury Duty show, like, fucking just, like, it made me, like, the funniest thing about rewatching these things was making me want to go back to Marsden, like, you know, to the show, because it was just, like, it was such a good pop of, like, comedic brilliance. But the second one is, like, that's the thing, that's the trick, right? Like, you can't just, lightning in a bottle is one thing, but to reproduce the Sonic lightning, like, but actually double down on it, and but actually create the universe that makes sense. Like, that's some shit, dude. Like, that was the thing that I was surprised about returning to it.
It would be like if they had actually made the sequel to Roger Rabbit, and like, you got there and you're like, there's no way they could do this twice. Like, this is just going to be like a pale imitation. And not only do they do it twice, they do it better than they did the first time, and you're just like, what?
Yeah.
Like, well, I can't believe they did it again. Like, it's great.
That's the thing is, like, and oh, God, RIP, the Roger Rabbit. Like, if anybody doesn't know what the sequel idea was, yeah, holy shit, you need to really Google it, because you would be fucking, you would be not only so sad, but you would also be, you'd be like, what? And the reason why it happened, the reason why it never happened was because of Back to the Future 2 and 3. And that's the saddest thing to me, is that
I would never want to
live in a world that doesn't have Back to the Future 2 and 3. I mean, because the trilogy to me, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but like that trilogy, like two, I mean, you know, like, you know, Ryan was always right about that. Like, it was the sequel to end all sequels.
Yeah. Me and him were, it's weird. We planted that flag so long ago.
So early.
And to have people now, like, coming around to being like, Back to the Future is really great. Like, I don't know that there's a lot of people that are like, it's better than the first one, like we are. But, yeah, me and him, like, growing up, like, we talked about Back to the Future Part 2 constantly. Yeah. And, it's so great to have people now acknowledging that, you know?
Yeah, acknowledging how complex and how brilliant it was and how much people stole from that sequel. Like, that literally people don't understand how much people have churned. Like, there's two sequels, I feel like three sequel films that I feel like people use as reference points. It's either Empire, Wrath of Khan, and Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, Godfather 2 is probably in there, in that conversation.
In there too. Yeah, so that's true. That's there's no diss against Godfather Part 2, because it's like one of the top five films of all time, but it's like it isn't used as much as like the other ones because of pop culture. And I would say that Back to the Future 2 is kind of become the number one spot because of the Marvel of it all. And we'll get into like Marvel later on, but like, you know, the Russos stealing wholeheartedly from
just like two and three. Yeah, Back to the Future 2.
Yeah. That's literally like when you watch Endgame, you're like, holy shit, they're Back to the Future 2 this.
Yeah. Going back in. And I'm sure there are stories out there that did that before Back to the Future Part 2. 100%. But that was such a, like, huge thing. But anyway, we don't need to talk about Back to the Future. Sonic 3 is great. You'll have a blast with your nephews. The absolute only way to see this movie, I think, is if you have a child in your life, like, take them to the movies to go see this, even if they've already seen it. Like, my nephew Jace walked out of the theater just like beaming. He had such a great time. He was like, that was the best movie I've ever seen. And I mean, you're not wrong in that it's like Star Wars for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad they're gonna do more. Time will tell if Jim Carrey will be a part of it. He does get a, but he's gotten a little end in every Sonic movie.
So. He really has. Like you think he's done. I mean, I think it's like,
I will say there are two post credit scenes before I forget.
Okay.
Post credit scenes. I walked out, did not see the last one. I had to read what it was, but make sure you stay till the very, very end.
So. I will definitely report back. And like the whole thing with Carrie, like, I feel like they give that to him because he wants to have that open door. Like, he wants to have like, I mean, and he said like the makeup is intensive. Like, it's not like he said that it's not as intense as the Grinch, and he never wants to do that kind of stuff again, like the how intense the Grinch was with like 8 hours. But he said, like, you know, the double duty was both a challenge and a curiosity, and them giving him
like
out.
Am I wrong? He's never done where he's played opposite himself.
No, he's never had because, and I think he talked about it. He said, like, you know, Eddie occupied that space.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, during the height, it was like Eddie's resurgence. Like, when Jim came to a power, and I mean, like, I mean, if, for people that are probably listening to this, they didn't live through the nuclear bomb of, like, you know, Ace Ventura and the rise of Jim Carrey. But I mean, we did, and we knew how much he meant. I mean, he's like, I mean, you know, there's very few comics I feel like that were as superstar status as he was. But he was kind of very mindful of it. Like he said, he was like, Eddie took that space up and Eddie did it so well. And he's like, and I have a very specific style of comedy that was not that. And I just thought that I'd fail if I, like, cause like, I think they did bring him projects. I mean, of course, you know, you always get like things, yeah, right? Like,
because he's such a good imitator and like, it's hard to not, like, want to lean into that, be like, hey, you could play this character and this character, we'll pay you X amount of, you know, but you're right. Like, watching Eddie Murphy, like, starting with Coming to America, really, and doing it for such a long time where he would play multiple characters in a movie and then playing opposite of himself in a movie in multiple characters. Yeah, if you do risk, like, if you do a project like that at the same time, people just turning their nose up and being like, you're a copycat. Like, you're trying to hone in, steal some of that thunder. But like I said, doing it now, watching it, like, it's a shame that we get it at what could essentially be the end of his career, because like, when, except for maybe in Coming to America, like, when Eddie Murphy does it, you kind of always still know it's Eddie Murphy. Like, there's certainly times where you're supposed to see the connection, but you kind of just always know it's Eddie Murphy. And I'm telling you, you would not know that that's Jim Carrey if you didn't know it's Jim Carrey. It is wild.
That's great.
I mean, the makeup certainly helps. But it's just a complete vocal, like, their inflection is kind of the same, but it's a completely different voice.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Like I just kind of, well, you see the trailer and you can kind of tell that it is a different performance. Like, at first I was like, is that Carrie? And then you have to read it, and then you read about it and you go, okay, yes.
There is, again, not getting heavy into spoilers, but there's a moment where it sounds weird to just say they dance with each other in context of the film. It makes sense. There is a moment where they dance with each other, and like, kind of in like a Back to the Future 2 of it all, where you see all of them at the table and they're all being played by the same person. You are just sitting there going, like, I know that they do this with special effects, but I honestly can't believe, like, I can't see the seams. I don't know how they did this.
Well, like, I know that he had a double on set that was in the makeup. So some of the scenes where he collides together with him were done with a double that is actually Carrie's stand-in, who, like, for the most part, like, worked with Carrie to get the movements down of the performance. Something like that. That's what
I heard. You know, we've seen the facial swap things, online deep fake stuff. I can look at it, stand back and go, they 100% use digital effects. But the fact that you can't really see the seams, and it is like, it's not a different guy in the makeup with Jim Carrey and they obviously had to shoot it twice multiple times and from multiple angles with him playing both parts, and then like piece them together, even digitally. It's pretty amazing at how good it looks, you know. Whereas in, like, again, going back to Back to the Future 2, like, if you watch the special features of how they shot the scene with three Michael J. Foxes playing his daughter, his son, and Marty, older Marty, they did shoot it three different times, but they had to block it out and then piece the whole thing together. Like, it's not, like, superimposed. It's literally, like, three separate frames put together to make one frame, like a triptych or something. But anyway, yeah, had a blast. Absolutely can't wait for Sonic 4. It feels weird to be like, I'm happy they're fast tracking it. But outside of Robotnik, they really are starting to feel comfortable jettisoning these human characters. So, like, there's not going to be much for them to do. Like, it's literally just show up for a scene. I guarantee you, Marsden and company, outside of Jim Carrey, I don't think any, like real human actor had to be on scene in character. Maybe they shot for 4 or 5 days.
Makes
it sound like, oh, well, they're barely in the movie. They don't, and they're in the movie. They're an important part of the movie. They get fun little things to do, but it's not the way it was in Sonic 1. Like, you were talking about Marsden carrying Sonic 1, and he really does. But they've all done such a good job of making you believe that these characters do exist in this world that they've made themselves irrelevant. Like, that's other than needing people wild to exist in the world because they're in the real world, there's not much for them to do. You know,
they've already done the heavy lifting of the series early on.
They're just moral support. Literally just moral support. Every once in a while in the movie, it's like, oh, we need a person because we can't just walk into a building and be like, hey, I'm here to see so-and-so, you know, because we're animated hedgehogs. So, or a hedgehog, a fox, and a whatever the hell Knuckles is.
Knuckles is, yeah. A combination of both.
But yeah, you'll have a blast. I'm excited for you to see it. I mean, it kicked the shit out of Mufasa at the box office.
It really
Sorry,
did.
Sorry, Barry Jenkins.
It really did. But I mean, at the same time, you know, you can't, like, I feel like this year Disney got put on notice that they have to do better. Because between Sonic and Wicked, because, like, Wicked is now, like, on track to become, like the biggest, like, one of the biggest movies of the year, if not the biggest, because it just passed $400 million, and it still has the whole, like, this is, like, what people don't understand is this week, like, because people are off for the next, like, until six, this is the time where movies just all of a sudden, like, break records, because, I mean, Disney is still going to probably, like they said, it's projected to make $200 million, like Mufasa. So, like over this week, over this next, like, 10 days that it's been out, right? And so it's not going to be a big deal. But the bigger thing is that Sonic, just like Wicked, is getting all the press. Like, nobody's talking about Mufasa. Like, I don't see it online. And I don't see anybody still not talking about Moana 2. And right now, like you said, like, Wicked is on track. Like, it's, like, here's the wild part about Wicked. Is that it's about to be released on Premiere VOD on New Year's Eve, while it's still making a shit ton of money. It's literally shitting gold bricks right now. It's going to make $500 million. It's going to make $500 million in the U.S. Now, of course, it's saying a lot because of the fact that it is a U.S.-based, like, internationally, it's not done well, but I don't think that it's been released internationally. There's not been a lot of places that it's been released. And it's a three-hour movie. There's other movies that are going on right now out internationally that are probably taking the spotlight. But I mean, just think about that.
Yeah, I don't think Wicked musicals translate as well.
No, they do not. because English language.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
that's really difficult. So that's to be expected. I'm sure Mufasa will be fine with the international box office.
Yeah.
Like the Lion King did a shit ton of money. People have a lot of love for those kinds of stories, and Disney always does well. You know,
internationally.
Stuff like that internationally.
But it's the trying. Like Sonic tries, Wicked tries, and I just feel like Moana didn't try, and I'm fairly certain, like, you know, Barry Jenkins is great, but like
he's kind of not disowned it, but like towards the end, like his last little bit of press was like, I mean, there were no actors on set. I just did what I could.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like,
it's such a...
I don't know. They paid me money, and I was just like, I don't know how the Lions do this. And then somebody put it into a computer.
And, like, the wild part is that he probably got paid. He got paid. And I'm not mad at Barry for doing that because,
not at all.
if that allows him
to take that paycheck, man. Like,
exactly.
You mean I have to? I'm sure he like worked with the voice actors, like like directing, like all of that stuff. But that's, I'm not saying that's not work, but it's definitely not the same as being on location with people having to worry about, like, it's just like, hey, when can you be here to record? Okay, I'll be here to record too. Like, there's no, like, well, they didn't eat breakfast this morning. Like, we're on your schedule, man. We just got to have it done by this time. Let me know when you can be in the studio. Like, a lot less stressful than making something on location in actual live action. So, I'm good on him, man. It is kind of funny that, like, again, like you said, the Mufasa will make money. It'll be fine. But that it's definitely not doing what they thought it would do.
No, they didn't. It isn't. But also, like, when you decide to go and prequelize something, just because you don't, like, I don't know what the deal was with that, but when you prequelize something and you don't bring back the people, like, so, like, the thing is like this, is that you probably couldn't get either Beyonce or Donald Glover to do anything more than a cameo, but they are that movie, right? Like, they are that movie. Like, you bring them back for a sequel, not a prequel, that you literally do the home video version. I mean, they literally did the video version, like, you know, that's the, what is that, Lion King 1.5, where it's not the baboon that tells them,
it's Timon and Pumbaa, and it's kind of Lion King 1.5 is kind of the, like, or the two dudes in Hamlet
Guildenstern and Rosenstern, Guildenkrantz and Rosenstern,
It's like that version of the Lion King story, because it's Timon and Pumbaa kind of like weaving themselves throughout, like, Mufasa's history, and then like the early days of Simba, and then that's you're right, that's what, from even some of the trailers, like, okay, so you're just doing this version of that, and, like, I don't think anybody wanted that, but, you know, more power to you. So,
exactly.
But you got to see Nosferatu, which I've heard nothing but good things about. I'm going to be honest. I have very little interest in seeing this.
Okay, this one's a tricky one because it's... Okay, so... If you're a horror fan, I am going to tell you, absolutely fucking need to see this in the big screen, because this is a special one. Like, Robert Eggers, like, and it's on track to make, like, a lot of money. Like, I was genuinely shocked. Like, it's, all the predictions had it making, like, a very minimal amount of money. Like maybe, like, 20 million at the end of the day. It's on track to make, like, 50 to 60 million by the end of the this weekend, and then close to like 100 by the end of the holiday season, which is, it's not baffling to me. It makes sense because horror, like, this is counter programming, right? Like, this is where, like, you know, the horror fans get something truly special and truly like good for them. But here's the thing. So there's two things. It's a both a compliment and I think it's kind of a critique for me. So if you've seen Bram Stoker's Dracula, if you've seen any of the Dracula movies, it literally is a carbon copy of that. Like literally there are scenes lifted from Bram Stoker, Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Like the whole opening 20 minutes is kind of like, it's a recontextualization, but it's literally Keanu and Winona, like, you know, young lovers in love, except for it's Nicholas Holt playing the Keanu role and Lily Rose Depp playing the Winona role. And like, just imagine if Nosferatu was told with Gary Oldman's, or like Bram Stoker's Dracula, Gary Oldman's bat version. Do you remember like the bat version? Very terrifying. Like, that's literally what Count Orlok is. That's like what Bill Skarsgård's makeup looks like, except for he has a mustache. It's just weird ass mustache. But the like visually stunning, dreadful, like in a way that like even got me in a certain moment. In certain moments, like that's the trick of this movie is that there's a sustained dread and a sustained feeling of uncomfortableness that Robert Eggers does that, like, you have to applaud it because it's literally like you, like, I, like, honestly, like, in a long time, like, since The Witch, like, his first movie, with Anna Taylor-Joy, Anna Taylor-Joy, like, that kind of uncomfortableness of, like, something out there being very, like, they do the alien thing where they keep his look at a minimal until the end, which is very effective, but it is very much so Bram Stoker's Dracula or the 78 Dracula or the original Nosferatu. It literally is almost a shot-for-shot remake at certain points of those different movies, but it's done in a weird way where Eggers is such a stylist and he has such control of the image. Like, I knew that before, but here's the thing is that he does, like, with the budget that he does it with in this movie, it's like you understand how good of a filmmaker he is and how much people are going to want to work with him again. This is not, like, at the end of the day, this is a minor film for him because there's one thing that it brings to the table that I was very intrigued by, but the story wise, man, they watched Coppola's Dracula and were like, okay, well, we can use this, we can use that. And they stitched together their own story, but it's literally scenes are very much so, like, they have the Renfield character and he's like in an insane asylum with the doctor. And he does the same thing that with the exception of one thing, he escapes. He gets out. Like the Renfield character and the Stokers we know dies, right? But he gets out, and he's the reason why the Demeter is there, and the Demeter does the same, like the ship, and it does they do the same thing that they did in Bram Stoker's Dracula. Like, it's really wild how much they adhere to his script. But here's the thing. I think it's a good thing because it is so visually and, like, it's visually oppressive. It's fucking dread. It's got this tone that you get out of it, you feel yourself like kind of actually unconstrict because you were so tense in the movie. Like it deals with the pandemic at a certain point. That's a kind of a new wrinkle. But the biggest new wrinkle is that the opening moments and then throughout the story, you get to understand that the Lily Rose Depp character, she has always had the Nosferatu in her life. And it begins with, and she tells this, like, the movie begins with her being, and this is something that people should know, this is an R-rated movie. This is a very comfortably R-rated movie that deals with sexual.
I saw the who was it that Eggers gifted the prosthetic penis to.
It was Nicholas Holt.
Yeah.
Holt, because like, he's in the scene with, and yeah, that's fucking terrifying, dude. It, and I mean, it is not something that's not there. It is very much so there in the movie. But the movie opens, and I should let people know, because this is something that I don't think that they're talking about. This movie is about sexual abuse. Like, and not just any kind of sexual abuse, child sexual abuse. Because, so the film opens with Lily Rose Depp's character coming out of her palatial estate to run through the maze, and then her father finds her, and literally she is being like mentally raped is the only thing I can say. And then we find out, like, there's a cut and we don't see all of the stuff that happens to her, but we basically find out that Orlok, since a child, was like in her dreams and grooming her until she turned 18, and then literally has his way with her and continues to have his way with her throughout this time. But nobody believes her, and she has to go into asylums. And it's implied that basically she was like at the hands of other men until she found this, she was in and out of asylums until she found Nicholas Holt's character and his love. And this is the weird part about this, his love for her, like, forced Orlok out of her mind. But then Orlok has been trying to find a way to get back into her mind in his obsession with her. And that's why he finally finds a way through Nicholas Holt's like holding company. And that's how they, because it's all this story of like this sexual abuser trying to come back into her life. And then the even wilder part is how Eggers, like, even though it's a remake, they contextualize it so that every single man is a piece of shit in this era. And basically the Van Helsing character basically gaslights her into having another bit of sexual congress with this demon in order to save the rest of the world, because the only way to kill this demon is through sunlight. It's a wild, very dark, very oppressive movie. That's kind of like the through line. I've been thinking about it for days. And like I said, like, it really doesn't hold back on this whole thing of sexual trauma. To which, like, every single person that I've seen joke about this whole thing about, oh yeah, she's choosing this, like, you know, demon and shit, I really want to fucking go into people's comments and go, who the fuck are you? What fucking movie have you seen? This is about a woman who's fucking, like, he's taking on hysteria in a really big way. But I think I think that the problem is that Lily Rose Depp does most of the heavy lifting. I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm just like, Eggers could have given her more of a push, with his story, but his story is so cookie cutter. And I know the reason why. So this movie was produced by Chris Columbus, and I have to applaud him because he made a movie that, like, he got Eggers to make a movie that feels like a commercial movie, even though it's a Robert Eggers film. So, like, it still has all of the of an Eggers film, but Chris Columbus guided it so it's a commercial film. So, like, you know, the cookie cutterness of the story is very much feels like a Chris Columbus. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. Like, and Eggers has talked about this. He's like, you can go online and read his stuff. He has nothing but effusive praise for Chris Columbus because Chris kept all of the money men at arm's length from him. And he knew how to do that because of, he says, he's like, Harry Potter, he's like, I just went through this with a Dracula film. He's like, I don't know how that man made an actual narrative film, the first two Harry Potters. He's like, I don't know how he did it because he had to be his own producer on that and also be the director and also be like story is king here. And he's like, I just went through this with this little vampire film. And he's like, I got to make the movie that I wanted to make with few concessions. But he's like, I want to work with Chris Columbus for the rest of my life, but I know that I can't. He's like, because he's that good. And you can feel the hand. You can feel the commercial hand. And that's Chris Columbus. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like Eggers has said that one of their touchstones that they talked about was Young Sherlock Holmes, which is a script he wrote, right? And so, but when you think about that, that kind of makes sense for this movie. It's a very complex, very dark movie. I don't think that I'm not surprised, but I am surprised how well it's doing. I don't know how it's going to do post, unless it starts getting like nominations. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's surprising. Like, I would not like, if Eggers gets a director nomination, I'd be like, that dude deserved it because of how stylish the film is. I will be very upset if Lily Rose Depp does not get at least a supporting nomination, because she is that fucking good in this movie. Like, I've never liked her in anything. I thought she was a Nepo baby. I take that back, because even if she is a Nepo baby, we got a performance that I feel is going to be one of those ones that women are going to talk about for a long time. Like, it's an all-timer.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems I have with that term, is that, like, there are a lot of Nepo things out there, especially in acting, but like, there's also like, I mean, Michael Douglas is a Nepo baby.
Yeah, he is.
But he's fucking Michael Douglas, man.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Curtis. I don't know, like, I understand why people shouldn't get something just because they're the child of someone. Like, I understand just giving them that just based on that. But there are a lot of Nepo, quote, Nepo babies out there. It's like, oh, wait, they have legit talent. And so you can't just immediately disqualify all of that. Lily Rose Depp, I've only seen her in a few things. She's certainly talented. Even in like something as like weird and bizarre as like Yoga Hosers, it's just like, yeah, there's talent there. So, you know, it is, you know, what it is.
Yeah.
I'm glad she's getting bigger and bigger things. Probably some of that comes from working with Quentin, right?
Yeah. And like, I mean, this is what breaks her. Like, this is definitely what breaks her. I know that she had the Idol was terrible. Like, that was supposed to be her big break. And to be perfectly honest, like, that is a terrible fucking show. It's a terrible fucking show. It's stupid. It doesn't make sense. Like, even her role, like, she just, like, all she's doing, you know, that meme of McConaughey smoking, looking at his phone. That's literally her performance. Like, that's how bad it is. But this, I feel like, is going to kind of break her in a way that, like, people are going to take her seriously, like, really seriously. Because it's that good. Like, she is that good in this movie. She is the reason to see this movie. Like, I will flat out say that. She is the fucking reason. It's not any of the other guys. It's not Bill Skarsgård. It's not Nicholas Holt, Aaron Taylor Johnson, or Willem Dafoe. Though Willem Dafoe is kind of great. Like, he understands it. Like, he understands what his role is as Van Helsing, or as the Van Helsing character, but honestly, it is a stage for Lily Rose Depp, and I mean, that's the reason to go see it, but also to, like, you know, Eggers' style, and just, like, a true, if you're looking for something that's, like, a true horror film, like, if people start calling this a masterpiece, which I feel like they will in a couple of years, I'm not going to be mad at them. I really not, because I started banging the drum for The Witch as soon as I saw it, and it is a masterpiece, a small M masterpiece, but it's still a masterpiece. And I think that this is still a small M masterpiece. Like, I wouldn't be mad if people say that. And like I said, in like five, like in 2 or 3 years, when people like start doing those things. But it's interesting. It's like, just for the fact that if you like, unique visions. How they got this through the studio system, even a mini major like Fox or like Focus, which is basically a universal indie shingle. Yeah, go see it. So okay. So yeah.
I want to ask you about something that's not film or TV related at all. We've not talked a lot of football this year. We definitely haven't talked any college football this year, but it's been fascinating for the last like 4 or 5 days to watch the Pop-Tart Bowl stuff.
Oh my God.
What an insane thing. And like everybody embracing it just makes it so much more fun. Cause like, well, I'm sure there are people who aren't, but for the most part, at least social media seems to be embracing the absolute batshit insane things that they were like, what if we make a trophy that is also a toaster and really works?
A toaster strudel. a toaster.
Well, what if we have a live edible mascot?
Like, and then we cannibalize it. What the actual fuck, dude? Like last year, they were
to literally paint the sprinkles on the sidelines. Like, so it's just sprinkles on the sidelines of the Pop-Tart Bowl. It's like, I'm like, man, this is wild. And I'm so here for it. I'm just like, I would want to play in the Pop-Tart Bowl, man. Like, national championships, great, but like, we want a trophy that's also a toaster that we can just cook Pop-Tarts in.
My favorite part is that it started, before it was the Pop-Tart Bowl, it was the Cheez-It Bowl, which I find truly hilarious that you went from savory to sweet, but it was the mascot, and then what got everybody was the mascot, and then it was the eating of the Pop-Tart. Like, the Pop-Tart went into the toaster and came out as a full-on Pop-Tart that you could eat. And the first people that tried it were like you could tell, like, if you rewatch it on YouTube, guys, you can see that the kids were like, what the fuck are we doing? We're eating
Did you see Pat McAfee talking about it?
Yeah, I saw that douche nugget was saying.
I forget who he was talking about. He was like, Gabe was going off on somebody who's like, can you believe there are psychopaths in this world who eat Pop-Tarts that don't have frosting on them? He just kept going off about like, why would you choose to eat unfrosted Pop-Tarts?
Tarts. Yes. I was like, you know what? There are times where, you know, you make some salient points and you did, but it was just like this. He went on about it. Came a problem for like all things Pat McAfee. It becomes a problem for me because he goes too far, like Stephen A. Smith. Right. You know, but yeah, I kept on watching. I was like, you are a fucking weird dude. You are a weird dude. I'm like, oh, good Lord. Good Lord. But yeah, like the Pop-Tart Bowl is wild. Like I'm just like, really?
It's been a lot of fun to just watch it. I'm just literally watching it play out on social media, but it's been a lot of fun. Like, you know, we need more of stuff like that. It's nice. All right. So
I will say this much. It was the only college football game that I've watched this year because I don't watch college football it's still good that people like, I will say this. It's still like the NIL stuff is good because kids are getting paid. But to be perfectly honest, I'm still like, fuck the NCAA because they're still making money hand over fist until the kids make. Like, all the kids are making money, like, all of them, not just stars, but all of them. And I'm not talking, like, I'm talking about the same level of money that the NFL, like, NFL players are making. Fuck you, NCAA, because you are making more, like, you know, like, you know that they make more money than the NFL. Like, I'm just going to say that to everybody here, is that I don't want no more discussion other than they make two times more. The NCAA makes two times more money on college football than the NFL makes on professional football. And don't even get me started on NBA versus NCAA, because it's even larger than that.
The NBA is repeatedly shooting themselves in the foot. So,
Jesus Christ.
In a decade, it's going to be hockey. Like, it's going to be those numbers of like, oh, nobody's watching this. Like, yeah, you made it impossible for people to watch. So, anyway. All right. So we both also got to finish Shrinking season 2. Which is much heavier material. I've been keeping up week to week. You were kind of binging episodes like 3 or 4 at a time, right?
Yes, I was, because I feel like it's the, like, you watching this week to week, man, I applaud you, brother, because I honestly do not
It was very cathartic. Like, was definitely my emotional release thing for the week. Like, okay, I need to like get some feelings out. So I'm going to sit down, I'm going to put on Shrinking, and I'm going to feel all the feelings, because that's what that show does. I listened to an episode of Fake Doctors, Real Friends. They had Brett Goldstein on a couple of weeks ago, and I caught up with it while I was on vacation and listened to it. And he talked about getting Harrison Ford. Like, that was one of their big questions was, how did you get Harrison Ford? And he was talking about, like, when they were working on the script, it was written for, quote, a Harrison Ford type. And Ford was in London shooting Indiana Jones. They had, like, through Hollywood means, like, know somebody, reached out to his representation about, they're like, let's just shoot for it. Gonna send him the script. And they got a reply back that, like, Harrison's in London, he can't leave. Well, and they were like, well, Brett's in London, so Brett, can you go meet with Harrison Ford? And he's just like, I don't think I can do this, man. Like, I can't do it. And so they give him Brett's number, and he's like, all of a sudden, I'm getting a phone call. I answer it. Harrison Ford is on my phone, on my cell phone, asking me, can I meet him at like this day and time? And I had to tell him, no, I can't, because I have a gig and those people have already paid, and I don't want to cancel on them. And because he's also a stand up. And so he has to call Bill Lawrence and Jason Segel back and be like, he said he could meet then, and I can't because I have a gig. He's like, and Bill tells me, cancel your fucking gig. It's Harrison Ford. He said, so I called Harrison Ford back and said, hey, can you do this time? And Harrison said, yeah, meet me at my place. I guess he had rented a place or something while he was over there filming. And he said, he walks in, and on the coffee table is like a pile of scripts, and the Shrinking script is on top of it. And he looked at Brett and he said, it's the best script I've ever read. And Brett was like, I didn't think he was talking about our script. I thought he was talking about one of the other scripts. All of that to say, like, there's a lot of moving stuff in this season. The shit that we see Harrison Ford do in this season, specifically in the finale, is not anything we've ever really gotten to see Harrison Ford do.
Never.
When he gives that speech in the finale, Like, yes, it's from the character, and yes, he is like leaning into the moment, but you, it kind of also feels like it's coming from Harrison Ford. Like, it is so moving and just like gut-wrenching, man. What an absolute brilliant piece of, like, everybody's doing great work, but getting to see Harrison Ford do things as an actor that number one, he gets to be funny, because anybody that's worked with him will tell you, like, he's a funny guy. Like, he has this dry wit to him. And number two, he gets to be vulnerable. And that's not anything we've ever really gotten to see Harrison Ford do. Like, he's always played kind of, I don't want to say a tough guy, because he's not Arnold or Stallone, but just this kind of like gruff man, quote, man's man kind of guy. And
very much so.
Like, you can look at this and be like, I understand why he kind of just, not retired, but just stopped doing stuff, and why he didn't really want to come back and do a lot of these other things, you know, why he didn't want to do Star Wars.
Absolutely. Like, because is it wildly inappropriate to say that it's like, after watching this, it's kind of beneath him? Like
all of those other things? No, absolutely. Yeah. Like, watching this performance, you know, and we love those things. We love Indiana Jones. And he does too, but we love Han Solo. We love Star Wars. Like, all of those other things he's done, like, even the stuff that people might would think of as minor, we really enjoy. But looking at his work here, no, absolutely. Like, you had this guy the whole fucking time.
Yep.
You had this guy
the whole time. Yep. We did. And we didn't, we gave him shit. Like, we literally, it's like, I was thinking about it, and it was like, okay, so like the comp to me now, after I've thought about it long and hard, is it's not Clint Eastwood. It, like, if we had anything that's close to him, it's McQueen. But McQueen didn't start doing this until right before he died. And we never got this chapter of him. I mean, hell, we're getting this at 80. Like, let me repeat that. Harrison Ford is 80 fucking years old. Like, it's almost 80. He just turned 80 this year, I think. He turned 80 this fucking year. And we are barely getting this from him. Like, he has been allowed to do this, but he has been capable of this the entire time. It's just nobody wanted it. Like, I mean, you watch Presumed Innocent, you watch The Fugitive, and they are genre films, but dramatic genre films, and you can see it there. Like, you can see the connections. Like, they're like those two films, or even like Regarding Henry, like a movie that has been much maligned, but I will tell you, like, my family was always Ritz crackers. We were huge fans of that, even though it's wildly inappropriate now. But you watch that and you see there's nothing wrong here. There's no, like, it's not Harrison Ford's fault that movie doesn't work. It's because it's a little too maudlin. It's a little too sweet and not enough sour. But we've had, like you said, we've had him this entire fucking time. And the saddest part is that studios would have rather have had him say, get off my goddamn plane than this. And at the end of the day, like, I feel like it's fitting that he's possibly going to end his career here. Like, I don't think that, like, why would he stay? Why would he do anything else? Like, if you're getting written perfect, like, you're getting written a perfect role, a role that'll probably define you as much as, like, I'm not gonna preface this, because I honestly feel this is that at the end of the day, it's going to be Han Solo, Indiana Jones, and oddly enough, it's going to be Dr. Phil Rhodes. Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, because he's that fucking good. Like, it's wild. Like, it's wild. Like, isn't it wild? we're getting this gift. Like, we're almost, we're respectively in our mid-40s. Like, very much so in our mid-40s. And we have watched this man our entire lives. And I can honestly say I can honestly say this is, the gift that is giving. That is, I sit there and, I had to hold back the tears when he was saying his speech, because you could tell that it was partially him. It's a very reflexive, performance where it's like you could tell it was as much about the character as it was about him and what this role has meant to him. And him being able to say it around all of the actors that he's worked with, respectively, on this show. I mean, Jesus Christ! It's something that's beyond special. Special is Ted Lasso. Shrinking, I don't even know what it is. I don't think we have the space to unpack it. So much so that I feel like I'm going to say something that's like, when Harrison Ford passes, I'm not going to be able to watch Shrinking.
Yeah, it's like the way tough, man. It won't be like watching Star Wars. It won't. I don't think it'll have, especially if I watch Force Awakens, it'll have a little bit of an impact for sure.
Yeah.
But Shrinking, like watching this man, just put it all out there and I know we've seen Harrison Ford cry on screen before, but not like this, you know?
No. There's a generation of men that are going to watch this and they're not going to know how to process it, because he is once in a generation there is a star that comes around that defines a generation. For us, that's Harrison Ford. For our fathers, there were a couple of them, right? You could take your pick between Sean Connery, Steve McQueen, and Clint Eastwood. Most of them would say it's Clint. My dad would say it's Clint.
Yeah.
I don't know about your dad, but my dad would definitely say it's Clint, because, the first badass he ever saw was The Man with No Name. You know, my dad still remembers the experience of seeing those movies, because he didn't see them one at a time. They actually had, they got released as a triple feature once they, the last one was a big hit, and he saw them all over one day, and it transformed him. It made him, Clint Eastwood, he knew him from Rawhide. Every kid knew him from Rawhide. He was Rowdy Yates or whatever his name was. And then he came out and it was like, that was fucking Clint Eastwood. You knew the name. By the time that The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly started, you knew the name. And that's what my dad said. And I mean, he took me to every Eastwood film. So it's that kind of gravitas, right? But Harrison Ford, it's he never had the chances that Eastwood did to do the dramatic work, right?
Yeah.
And he's getting it now. And like you said, he's putting it all on the table. And it's not just the emotional stuff. It's the comedy, the drama, the way that he feels like a human being, in a way that you don't, to see him, I think part of the hard problem of it is that, for me at least, when I was watching it this year, was to see him so vulnerable, and to see the anger there, to see the vulnerability in the quiet moments, the accepting that he's having this disease that's going to take him. And then he says at the end, he's like, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to say this to you or tell you this or work with you. And it's both mortality from an actor, but it's also mortality of a character. And man, there's this, in the most perfect world, this would have been a film and he'd get all the Oscars. He would win his Oscar. Deservedly so. Not just for his career, but for this role. And he's going to win all the Emmys this year. He's going to win everything this year. because it's that good. And like the weirdest part about this is that he's not even he's not the biggest part of the show. Like, there's still a whole other part of the show that we haven't even talked about. And that's how great Shrinking is that we can zero in on this one. Harrison Ford is the...
Yeah, it's so deep. So, so freaking deep. Because you have all of these complex relationships. And they get all of it so right. We could do literally just a Shrinking podcast. The relationship between Jason Segel and his daughter, like, just over two seasons, like, be at its lowest and then get built back up and then destroyed again, and kind of like them being able to put it together, like, back together kind of quickly. And it does kind of show you, like, the value of therapy, like, just from the point of view of having someone say, someone else outside that circle say, well, but maybe this is what that person was thinking when they did that. And you're seeing it from only a perspective of, it hurt me, you know? And
yeah,
they're seeing it, you know. And then just the Lewis of it all, speaking of Brett Goldstein.
Those final moments.
Giving you a character who did a horrible thing and making that character a difficult person to hate, but also understanding why you would hate him.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a unique way to go about that. Especially in a day and age where we have characters who should be easy to hate and are somehow lauded as heroes by certain subsects of, and I'm not talking about just in media, in real life too, but in media, definitely you have like a character like just Homelander, for instance, who should be not saying he's not fun to watch, but should be an easy character to absolutely hate. And yet somehow there are people out there who beat the drum on, you know, well, he's not the bad guy. Having a character that is the bad guy, but is difficult to hate because of who he is versus what he did. And that's an important thing too. You know, like, you are not your worst mistakes.
Yes. Like that's I love that part of the TV show is that you are never your worst mistake. Your worst mistake shouldn't ever define you. That you should be allowed the grace to learn from it.
But and also how difficult it is to accept that grace, to give it to yourself, to understand when people won't give it to you, like that that guy he works with who he thinks is his friend, is like, you never told me this. Why would I tell you? Why would I tell?
Yeah, like, oh. By the way,
I killed somebody. Someone.
Yeah.
Because I got drunk and drove. And you know, it helps that they show you the scene in the episode earlier, few episodes ago, of them, like, at dinner and having a drink or a few drinks. And, like, he's not so drunk he's stumbling out of the restaurant.
No.
And, you know, it's easy to look at, like, those commercials, the buzz driving is drunk driving. Like, it, those commercials, and just kind of like, whatever, like, don't tell me what to do. Or, yeah, or just to kind of scoff at them as kind of like cheesy and goofy and stupid. And then you like look at that situation, which I know it's fiction, but it's also like, this shit happens every day. Yep. And go like, yeah, this one moment, like, because he didn't want to walk or didn't want to call an Uber or taxi or whatever. And yeah, his life is changed forever.
Change.
And not yep. just his life, like all of but these so many of lives them. Are yep. changed forever. And he has to carry that weight around. And even though you have the daughter, like, kind of, she forgives him and, like, gives him that grace and, you know, is, I mean, I don't want to say accepting, but, like, she is his friend. And mm-hmm. he still can't give it to himself. Like, because in his moments, darkest moments, by himself, that's all he is his worst mistake. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, so much so that it, like, you know, that at his darkest moment when he is by himself, like he thinks the most the worst possible thought that a human being could have. And like,
why wouldn't he? You know, I'm like, maybe it's just because I come from, you know, I mean, you know,
yeah,
a place of depression. Like, yeah, yes. I can imagine I would be there too. Like, you know what? If I step in front of this train, it's over. Like, I don't have to carry this around anymore. I don't have to be a reminder. I will never have to risk someone else I care about in the future finding out this horrible thing that I did and then deciding not to love me.
Yep. And it's this thing that he doesn't understand, that he continues the concentric rings of hurt if he does.
Yeah.
And like, my favorite part about this, about the show and its ending, is that it's not Jimmy's daughter that makes him do what he does. It's Jimmy himself and it's Jimmy's own like actions and own onus, and him talking to Phil and Phil telling him, or Paul, I'm sorry, Paul telling him the things that, like, at the end of the day, like, Paul helping him through the worst part, even though he doesn't want to accept it, that allows him and gives him the strength to be able to do what he does at the end. Like, and like, it's not to say that the road is going to be easy. It does, like, this show never gives that impression, right? Yeah. It never does. Like, it never gives the easy answer. Like, and I feel like that's, like, you know, this year there's been a lot of that, not just with Jimmy, but with Alice, with Liz, with Brian. I mean, hell, even with Gabby. Like, Gabby does something that I really hated her for right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and that was, like, so... But I love when she, like, therapizes herself. And she's like,
yeah,
I'm so used to having to save people that having someone who I don't have to be like this Madonna figure for mm-hmm. just scares the shit out of her.
Yep.
Because it's not that he needs her. It's that he wants her.
Exactly. And like, when he does, like, when he walks out and the anger that he has, like, during that moment, it's like, you feel it, and you don't like Gabby, because all she has to do is just not like it's easier said than done, right? To get around yourself, like to just like go, yeah, just fucking invite him. And she doesn't feel like she wants to make it a game. And that's like where it becomes this issue. And yep. Then when he gets real about it, like when he's like, hey, we're going to do this. And he's like, and he sees what she's like, and he sees that she's joking about it because she thinks that she can just do that. And then he's like that painful fuck you, like that fuck you was the most painful fuck you I've ever heard.
It was because, rough, man. I was, when he said that, like my jaw was on the floor. I was like, oh, my heart hurts. I'm so shocked right now. Like I expected just like, oh, it's okay. I understand the TV version, which I mean, ultimately we do kind of get there, but
yeah,
like that in that moment, I was just like, holy shit. Like, yeah. But also, I mean, not judging him, fucking good for you, dude. Like,
yeah,
boundaries. This was a boundary. You lied. You kind of manipulated me. Like, I'm not playing a stupid fucking game with you. I'm not going to do it.
Just because I'm a nice guy doesn't mean I'm a nice guy. Doesn't mean I'm a pushover. And like, I got so mad at her. Like, I got so mad because, you know, it's like, you, like, it's not to say that there isn't anything wrong with Derek. It's just Derek is like, he was such a good guy and so good for her. And like, she was treating him like her ex, like the one that we saw at the beginning of the show, the heroin addict. Yeah. Like, she was treating him like that. And when he says, fuck you, you cut right, like, and what hurts the most is that you cut to every, like, the way that she treated him, just like Jimmy, just like her ex, and probably, like, a string of men that probably deserved it. But this is the one that doesn't deserve it. And her not seeing that is the most frustrating part about it, because everybody else sees it. Because she starts talking about, like, they ask him, have you invited him? No, no, like all this stupid shit. And you can feel like everybody's like, okay, why are you doing this? And we're even like with you, like with everybody that's talking to her about this. And it's like, you don't expect it to go there, but it does have to go there, because like that's life, right? You don't get to like play people like that and not have a consequence. And like you said, it does end happily, but it's nice to see that he, like, it gets dark. Like this show,
and she does have to come like hat in hand kind of to him and be like, hey, I fucked up. I'm sorry. Like, I can tell you, here's the reasons why, and, you know, I can give you, you know, whatever, but I just want to call and, like, set it right and apologize, and, which is also a really fucking important thing, like,
yes,
you know, a lot of people do not, I mean, myself included sometimes, don't, like, when you can step back and see where you went the wrong, you're just like, oh, well, yeah, I was wrong about that. Like, not making the effort to communicate that to somebody, to the person, and just be like, hey, I was wrong. I'm really sorry. Like, mm-hmm. I completely just fucked that up. I don't know why I acted that way. Like, I'm really sorry. And she does that. And, you know, that's an important part of him, like, coming back in and being like, which, you know, that was a really great entrance. It's like, I brought your mother. And that lady walks in. She's like, that's not my mother.
That's not my mother.
Kidnapped some random lady.
He goes, no, that's my aunt. Here's your mother. That was great. Like, that was like that was... That was kind of beautiful. Like, what I like about the show, and this is just in general, is they now know they're getting, like, they knew from the beginning of season two they were getting season three, and they've laid out some longer-term storylines that we're going to see happen evolve. Not just Paul's storyline, but, you know, and there he's my least favorite character is Brian, his best friend, the lawyer.
Yeah. Brian is because, like, good for seasoning.
Yes,
maybe not necessarily the meal. But
just because he's a terrible he's a awful person.
Yeah,
he's an awful person. Like, but anywho, like
opening that door, like with them adopting a baby, and like,
yes,
you're going to now have to see him, like, truly come to, even though he knows he's a very self-centered and selfish person, he's going to have to truly come to terms and reconcile that to himself.
Yeah.
Because there is now going to be another person wholly dependent upon him and the way he acts and his desires and thought processes. And like, he's going to have to change his mindset because he's going to have a child. And yes, that's going to make for some, I'm with you on like being my least favorite. But I do think there's a lot of moments where it's just like, yeah, he's really good. Like, he gets a lot of, like,
funny. He gets a lot of good laughs. Yeah. Yes, very much. Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, here's a question for you. And I did not know I needed a reunion, and I did not know they had as much chemistry. But Jesus Christ, I am looking forward to... I am really, really, really looking forward to Colby Smulders being in season 3.
Yeah, SOB. Like, holy shit, man. Like, so you definitely cast her because you know you're getting a season 3 and you're going to write this, like, Jimmy moving on thing.
And how much Alice is going, like, fine. Like, okay, so
yeah.
Can I say something? Fuck Alice this year. Seriously, fuck that little girl, because she's
it was rough in season 1, but you kind of understood, like, her dad had been so, like, so shitty for so long.
Yes,
you can kind of see it, and I know that, like, that doesn't just go away, even though he's apologized and trying to make amends and trying to get, but like, she does do a lot of things that it's just like, really? Really?
Yeah.
Like, you sleep with your best friend's boyfriend. Like, mm-hmm. you're hanging out with the man. I understand why. And, like, I understand you're, like, trying to be a good person. And, like, good for you for being able to move past that and see the man behind the drunk driver that killed your mom. But how do you not understand that your dad is absolutely not ready for this? And, like, you don't respect that at all. It's a very, like, yeah, she's rough. Like, I see where she's coming from and I see why she's doing or did what she did, but it is still also like, yeah, it's a lot of betrayals, man. And it's hard for those people not to see them as betrayals. And, you know, I mean, good on her friend for, like, moving on as quickly as she did. But, like, when she was being a total, like, bitch to her and just, like, sabotaging, like, you deserve it. Like, I don't know what to tell you. You slept with your best friend's boyfriend. Like, a dude who had pined after you for so long and you wanted nothing to do with, and then your best friend starts sleeping with him and dating him, and you're just like, okay, like, my life is in chaos, I'm gonna sleep with this guy now. Like, what? Yeah, it is really, really insane. Like, she's lucky she has good people.
Well, okay, and also, like, let's not as, like, the fact, okay, so, the fact that Paul says that she's okay, like, really speaks to how much she's actually telling Paul. Like, at first I was like, you know what the fuck is Paul doing? And then I think my wife pointed out, she's like, do you really think, like, other than because she got caught, cheating bitch is a viral thing, do you think he told her about anything else?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. Because Paul found out through Jimmy that his daughter, like, actually, he doesn't even know. Because if you think about it, when Jimmy has the Paul and Jimmy have that moment of confrontation where he's like, you are going to fucking come to me and I'm going to be fucking right because you need fucking help. I knew at the moment he walked in, if Paul had knew what Jimmy had gone through, there was no fucking way that Paul would have ever said that. And that's how good the fucking writing is between Lawrence Siegel and Brett Goldstein and the writing room, that they considered this. And you know absolutely Alice never said shit. Because why would she? Because she's listening to Brian, the worst fucking, like, Brian is very, very lucky that he still has this family unit that he does.
Yeah, because that's an even bigger betrayal, and I get, like, you see this dude is sad, you see he's hurting, it's all really, really rough. But going back to the Kobe Smulders of it all, it's interesting that, yes, it's a How I Met Your Mother reunion. It is bizarre that show was on for how long?
10 years.
Almost a decade, right at a decade. And those two were constantly together. Not once did it feel like, oh, there's some chemistry there.
No, not at all. But the, like,
immediately. Immediately.
Oh, God, yeah. I looked at my wife and I was like, oh man, like, I want this to happen now. And she goes, it's not going to happen now. She's like, next season. And then I thought about it. I was like, fuck, she's right. It's not. And this whole scene plays out. And you're like, holy shit. When did this chemistry happen?
Yeah, it is, like, wild that 10 years they were together on a show. And it never felt like even that, like, accidental, like, thing of, like, yeah, they definitely have just chemistry as actors together. Not that they... they were fine. They felt like buddies. But the minute they look at each other in this episode, I mean, that just speaks to, A, how great they both truly are. Yes. And B, just how good the writing and directing on this show is. The way it's framed, the way it's written, the dialogue, and just their ability. It's funny. Was it? I can't remember. It might have been Brett Goldstein that was talking about it and talking about getting in with Siegel and why he's the main character. And whoever it was, they were talking about the importance of casting someone like Jason Siegel in this part, because especially when you start, you have a person at their lowest doing absolutely terrible things to themselves and to the people around them, and specifically to their own daughter.
Yeah.
Like, treating people terribly. And you have to still be able to like them. And Jason Siegel has this thing of, like, even when you don't like him, you still want to like him.
Yes, you're always rooting for Jason Siegel.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what happens, like, you are always rooting because he's, like, okay, so, like, there's this thing about him that is almost Jimmy Stewart-esque.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of tall and lanky and kind of goofy, but at this core of him, you can tell he is a decent human being. Like, that's ultimately what I feel like, no matter what he does, no matter, and like, he inhabits a dad in a way that isn't cool, but it's relatable. Like, I've not seen a on like he is like the best on-screen dad, not like in the way that a dad is perfect, right?
Yeah, not but in that, a way that I know you're not supposed to mention Cosby, but not in that Cosby show way. Where it's just yes. like, oh, you know, always know the right thing to say. It's just, it's in the way that we all kind of, like, deserve. Not in the shittiness, but just in the being able to look at the situation and be like, either, A, I don't know how to handle this. B, I'm sorry I was, or like, whatever scenario, I'm sorry I was being a shitty person. And, like, mm-hmm. it, you know, I mean, I can't speak for you, but I could probably count on one hand the number of times my dad apologized for the absolute shitty way he behaved. So
yeah, no, absolutely. Like maybe on my maybe like you know me, like my ring finger, maybe. Yeah. Like yeah. But it's just the it speaks to how good of a like how like. Ineffable, like certain things are with actors, right? Like there's, I can't tell you the reason why Tom Hanks works like in that kind of same realm. It's just like, it's just, it's not a magic trick. It's just an aura, right? Like no matter how bad, like Jason Segel acts in his movies, there's never a moment where you don't relate to him and his follies. Like he's never cruel. It's never like there's this moment this year where they flash back to Jimmy at his worst, right? And he literally like he's asked to do something. He's asked to do something by his daughter and he does the worst fucking thing a human being can do. And he says, I just can't do it. I'm sorry, honey. Bye. And yeah. you should hate him instantly. But all you want to do is like, fuck Jimmy, do better. What the fuck? But then also go, he lost the love of his life. Like, you know, like, he lost the love of his life. I mean, how do you do that? And he gets put into these, like, what the brilliance of this show is that Jimmy is always put into these predicaments that are so human. And there is no possible way that any human being could do the right thing in these situations. And he doesn't. But he never makes it never is cruel or crass. It's always like, oh man, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Like, but you also understand because you're like, there's no fucking way that you could do the right thing in these moments, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, just the same as like anybody in this show. Like, that's the thing that I feel like is the beauty of the show is that there's never a moment where everybody, other than maybe Derek 1 and Derek 2, who are anomalies, right? But then those kinds of guys are anomalies anyway, right?
Yeah.
Like they really do exist. They're just not, like, they are, like it makes sense that the both of the Derricks are with the women that they're with. Because I've met dudes like that. I know, like, I hung out with there's a guy that is, like, he is my Derrick, right? His name's John. He's a video game, like he's a gamer, but he's a Twitch streamer. He makes, he lives the perfect life, right? He has three daughters. He's having a fourth, or no, I'm sorry, two daughters and or two boys and a daughter, and he has a fourth on the way, right? And he is literally Derek, and his wife is kind of like Liz, where she's very salty, but he is like sweet, and so they balance each other out, and it's like. I know for a fact that Derricks exist because I'm friends with one. Me and my family, me and my wife are friends with one. But they are such an anomaly, right? They are such a fucking anomaly. But that's okay. And that's the way that life works, right? And I feel like that's, for me, like, after watching two seasons, what I love about the show is that everybody is fallible. And more so than that, you always don't make the right decisions. And in fact, you make some really bad decisions, but that's okay. People will still love you at the end of the day, even if they are a punk ass 16-year-old little girl who's all up in her own ass. Like, they will still love you and they still will ultimately want the best for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, it is really, like, it is my favorite show. Like,
me and my wife were talking about it last night when we finished it up, and I just looked at her and I was like, this is my favorite show. Like, this is my favorite show on TV right now.
Yeah,
and
it's sucks a that I'm tough a- watch, but yeah. It's like an important thing, and it is something you have to be in the headspace for, but it's not a turn it on. Like, I can't turn it on and do something else. Like, I have to sit down and watch it and like engage with the show, and that makes it important. And yeah, I'm with you. It's like my favorite, currently running show.
I was telling you, I was kind of hinting at, this week we kind of like stocked up some What If episodes so that we could watch Shrinking and we could go between them, because it's really a palate cleanser to do this very wild, very fun show along with this heavy duty thing. Like, it's a very nice thing to do. And so What If season 3 just finished this morning, or last night, I should say, because at midnight
they released 8 episodes in 8 days.
Yes. And okay, I don't know about you, but I kind of love the fact that they did this model. But at the same time, now that it's done, there's this.
Yeah, it kind of sucks that it's done.
Yeah, right?
Especially because we're not getting a season 4. So, it's rough, man. I don't know. You want to do it just briefly, episode by episode?
Yeah. Let's do a brief episode breakdown, and then we'll go from there.
What if the Hulk fought the Mech Avengers, which is the most anime inspired episode of this show? I was gonna say to date, but ever, because we're not getting anymore. Taking inspiration from Voltron, Robotech, like all of those
Gundam.
Gundam. Very fun. It was like, I don't want to say it. Yeah, it's probably my least favorite of the whole bunch.
Yeah. It was okay, so I feel like, okay, so like, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't it feel like a good intro, right? Like a good, like it wasn't.
Yeah. You're starting kind of light, even though it's heavy material. Also, I should have prefaced the whole thing. I feel like they honestly thought, like, when these episodes went into production, the characters that we see in here that we know are going to be prominent in the MCU going forward, those movies were already supposed to be out. We should have already had the Captain America movie. We should have already had the Thunderbolts movie. Like, a lot of this stuff should have already been... the only one that actually came to pass, I think, before this show came out is Agatha.
And
because she plays a prominent role in one of the episodes. The second one, actually. But yeah, the first one... it's definitely the lower of all the episodes, and you're right. It's probably a good place to start, because if you stick this in the middle somewhere, you're going to lose the momentum. The fight scenes were fun. The Avenger Assemble, robot thing, that was fun. It was just kind of okay. So
I will say this much, there's an episode that happens way later that should have been coupled with this one. The Western one, it should have actually come after this one. So there was kind of a dynamic shift, because the momentum.
I agree with you there. Not because that's a lesser episode, but just because it feels like a break in between the momentum of the larger story.
Absolutely.
So
go ahead.
I was gonna go to the second episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the second episode is what if Agatha went to Hollywood, which the premise, it's interesting, Agatha discovers the what are they calling? Incursion, Starchild, the seed in the earth, and she takes its power and then kind of makes herself this Hollywood, like, forever young superstar, and works with Howard Stark as he's a movie producer, and like, it has this fun, like, fast, like, 40s dialogue, and
yes, it does, yeah,
like, rapid pace plot. There's a dance number, which is wild.
It really is.
It's a dance fight scene. Like, it's crazy.
Like, the Raiders of the Indiana Jones kind of, like I love the fact that they reference the dance number from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom with her, with the outfits of her girl, like, her girl Rockettes kind of style, like, dancers. But also, like, Kingo.
Bringing him back, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really fucking was. Like, in a way that I wasn't expecting. Like, I expected this one to be kind of my wife was really looking forward to this one because she loves Agatha, right? Like she loved Agatha all along. It was probably her favorite of the Marvel series that we've seen so far. Like, in a big way. Like that was, like, her favorite. So, like, her seeing, like Agatha come back in this glitzy Hollywood kind of thing, but then also Kingo, like, oddly enough, being, like, this whole Bollywood star which he was in the Eternals, but, like, being able to, like, give him this role and this kind of, like, it's not a romance, but it kind of feels like a romance of sorts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like it feels like it really does feel like His Girl Friday, where they're opposing forces, but they kind of, not that they love each other, but, like, they kind of love to hate each other. And that whole thing, that whole dynamic was, like, a lot of fun to see. And also to see Agatha turn hero, even though, you know, like, I love the fact that they knew about Agatha all along while they were making this.
Yeah. And that kind of the reveal that Stark kind of knew everything anyway was a lot of fun. Like, he's just like, but it's, like, free special effects for my movies, so why would I say anything? bringing both I just drew a blank on his name. Dominic Cooper. And Jarvis, whose name I also can't remember.
Darcy.
Yeah. James. Yeah, Darcy. Bringing them back, which they've been pretty fair game about coming back and voicing those characters, but
yes,
they have such a good dynamic that, like, it always just makes me feel sad that we didn't get more of Agent Carter, you know?
Well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that too, because, like, what's her name showing back, like, Haley Atwell, like,
big
goat of this show, like, and the goat all along. Like, that's the one thing that I didn't realize. But then, like, I went back really quickly and kind of looked at the episodes and looked at the...
Oh, yeah. It's weird that she's the key for this show when Marvel seems so quick to jettison her.
Yes.
Like, live-action Marvel just seemed like, oh, yeah, whatever.
I also have a theory about that, and it's a very crass and fucking shitty one, but I'll leave that for later. One thing that we didn't actually talk about, which I found really funny about the first episode, was that Oscar Isaac shows up for, like, four lines of
dialogue. It's Moon Knight. Yeah,
it's, like, it's Moon Knight.
What?
I was like, what? Like, does that mean that we're getting, like, obviously I feel like we're going to get more Moon Knight. Like, I feel like we're going to get him more in the...
They just got to figure out how to do it better.
Well, honestly, I think that he's going to show up in Avengers. Like, I think that this is his... Like, watching him in this made me realize, oh, you know what? They're probably going to have him in Doomsday. That makes sense to me. But yeah, like, going back to the Agatha went to Hollywood, that was a lot of fun because it was like... It started out, like, what I love about this show is that it understands style, and it literally opens up, like kind of going back to Wicked, it opens up with a credit sequence that feels totally like Yeah. It feels totally like a Hollywood like movie made in the 30s or 40s.
I enjoyed that they played around with the opening credits a lot in this season. Well, that was great.
Yeah, the moment with Jason Isaacs, and we'll get to that in a moment, but that was fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, all of the way that they played with those credits is, like, very much so, like it speaks to, like, I like, and we'll get to the next one, right, like, which is my favorite.
I was about to say, this, the what if the Red Guardian had stopped the Winter Soldier? Like, we hadn't really talked about any of the episodes past this in text or anything, but yeah, this, I would have pegged this one after watching. I was like, this is going to be Adam's favorite episode. Such a throwback to like 80s buddy comedies. Like,
48 hours. Like very 48 hours. Like because Guardian is literally, oh man, like it's just, it's, you know what? You know what I thought like instantly? And it's probably
Harper understands this fucking character the way, he just gets it. He gets, even if this dialogue is written, it's the way it's delivered. He understands the way it has to be delivered. And when they're at the restaurant and he's like launching into a tirade about like the workers and their rights, and they're like, and that girl is like, I don't even eat meat. Do you want?
Oh man, like it's just, and then it's just like, I really would have loved this as a live action movie, because Jesus Christ, both Sebastian Stan and David Harbour kill this fucking thing.
Yeah.
But then you've got like the added pop of things like Lawrence Fishburne playing Bill Foster.
Yeah.
Goliath, America Ferrera. Okay, so I have to ask, is Ranger Morales a throwback nod to eventually she is like the aunt or like great aunt or even grandmother of Miles?
I'm pretty sure that there's some relation in there. I'm not 100%.
Okay.
But I should have Googled it and I didn't.
Okay. I was just wondering if you knew, because I was like, man, like as soon as she made her name known, like it was kind of like everything's a nod in this film, but it's not a bad nod, right? Like I'm not saying like if she is, like that would just make it all the better, because like having America Ferrera voice this role is kind of like, it's not just what you kind of want, but it's what you expect from these people. And there's a, like, we're going to get to the next one in a moment, that definitely I have questions about, because but the tone of this is so perfect. It's so buddy cop comedy, like Midnight Run. Like it literally felt like Midnight Run, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And the way that like, the thing that made me like, I was like, fuck, I turned to my wife again, you know, to just talk to her. Like we're watching this and I was like, David Harbour is going to fucking murder it in Thunderbolts. Like, I feel like he is the fucking star. Like, I don't think that anybody has said this, but I think that he might be the star of that fucking movie.
He's just definitely going to steal the show. If he's not the star, he's going to steal the show. Like, he is so just pitch perfect. It sells every single bit of it. And yeah, I can't wait to see what that had me. It got me so hyped. I wish that the first episode had got me more hyped for Captain America.
Yes.
It just really didn't. I am still excited for it because it does still look good. But this episode specifically got me so like even more hyped. Like, cannot wait to see Thunderbolts, man. I feel like they're just going to knock it out of the park.
And the final moment of this episode, slow clap. I literally slow clapped because because that's what you kind of want from a what if episode, is the kind of pop, and to see him alongside the Avengers at the Battle of New York is just, it's too good.
Yep.
This is the only episode I've rewatched, and I've rewatched it three times. And It's the perfect, like, that's the last one that I watched before I started Hornswoggle and episodes, because, and it was Christmas Eve. So it was like the perfect Christmas Eve episode. Like, it made me, it just made me like love it. So the next episode is What if Howard
the Duck got hitched? Yes. I'm going to say this.
Okay.
Up until an episode that will come in a couple of minutes, this very surprisingly was my favorite episode. Like, I was like, holy shit, I don't know if they can top this. It is absolutely wild. It's insane. Like, it's so batshit. I don't like the character of what's her name? Darcy. I've not ever really liked her. I don't like the actress that much. Mm-hmm. She's fine. She does what she's supposed to do. It's just not appealing to me as a character. She's always kind of just playing the same role. But for whatever reason, like, it works with Seth Green's Howard the Duck, and like the goofiness of it, of like protecting this egg and then like running from everybody, and like the Grandmaster, and there's so much going on in this episode. Like, yes. I don't even know where to. When they show up on the Frost Planet and are talking to Loki, like, good on Tom Hiddleston for just, like, I mean, he's always game, but, like, being this, like, used car salesman of himself, version of himself.
Oh, God, like, yes.
It's so funny. And I've had so much fun watching this episode. And it, like, Sam Jackson even gets in on the fun. Fury Out was fucking great, man. So great. I loved this episode. It's I know that you can't do this level of goofiness in live action. People would just be like, no. But like, leaning into it just for like this little bit, I just absolutely loved.
I mean, like, I'll be honest with you, it is the wildest, funniest, fun episode that they've produced. Like, my wife actually said something. She's like, Darcy is the only person in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that would have sex with Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Like, and it makes sense. Like, that, like, and fall, not only have sex with him, but fall in love with him and have a relationship. Like, it makes sense that Darcy ends up with Howard. Like, and I was like, you know what? She's right. And then the progeny of their, like, and then we're going to get to that in a moment, because I have serious questions about that and what your theories are. But the progeny of, like, of Darcy and Howard is perfectly cast for the voice that eventually becomes Birdie. But we'll get to that later. But I just love the fact that they use the Kiss song, Made for Loving You, through the whole entire thing, including a battle cry, which is amazing. Like, I fucking, like, everything about that that episode was kind of brilliant. Which leads us to the what if the emergence destroyed the Earth, which
definitely the darkest episode of this season.
Yeah. And like, it was okay.
Yeah. Here's the problem. What I said earlier.
Yeah.
We should have had a stronger relationship with Riri Williams as a character going into this show. We absolutely do not. We've only had one appearance from her back in Black Panther, which now has been ages ago, it feels like. And so her being the main character, it doesn't have the drive it needs to.
So no.
You're not as invested in the story, because you're not as, the watcher is so invested in what keeps happening to her, but you're not, because you don't have a lot of investment in that character.
Well, but then also she doesn't show up as one of the pseudo Avengers in the later episodes, yeah. Which also doesn't, like, was that a writing thing? Was that a thing that
I don't know? Didn't write?
Because that felt like a huge, huge misstep. Because I was like, okay, well, Riri is, like, she does what she does. He's invested in her. She's going to eventually show up again. And it's like, okay. It felt very kind of, like you said, like, we should have had Ironheart already. And we should have had a connection to her, but we didn't. And it also, the other thing is that they're using a lot of people that we have not, like, Quentin Beck, Power Broker Sharon Carter, Sharon Carter, Power Broker. And then, like, it was just, like, this thing where it's like, okay, huh, interesting. It was not my favorite episode just because, like, I appreciated how dark it got, but because it didn't pay off later on, I was like, because, I mean, we all know what happens in the last two episodes. It's always about something bigger, like an Avenger-style kind of thing, which we love. Like, I love that. I love you build up to the final two episodes, and it becomes a thing. But the thing is that they chose somebody different, to which, well, we'll get to that in a moment.
You also have Quentin Beck as the main, like, I get why, because of what is in the thing, and it's like, I don't have a lot of investment in that villain either. Like, it's an interesting take on him being like the big antagonist, but like, we don't really care about Mysterio that much, you know. He was a one and done villain, so it definitely a dark episode. It'll be interesting to revisit it as some of those characters become more important down the line.
Absolutely.
Episode six, What If 1872, which is now my favorite episode of definitely of the season, possibly of the show, period.
Oh man.
Like, it's right up there with Captain Carter, man.
Yes.
Like, holy shit.
Just
everything is perfect. Everything.
And our boy shows up. You get Walton Goggins when you need a man that's named Walton Goggins to show up. And of course, he's in a Western. Like, you don't.
Yeah. I mean, just Western doing what he has to do, you know?
And Deep State, thank you to Marvel MCU understanding that Wyatt Russell needed to be in this.
Yep.
Because the tombstone of it all, though I really wish that Kurt would have shown up too. But man, this episode was fucking wild and fun. And didn't you just want, like, after watching this, didn't you want Shang-Chi to find a way to go back into the West?
Yeah, man. I was like, fuck, I just want my Western Marvel now. Not the Marvel Western characters, the superheroes, like set in that era. Like, it just felt so much fun, and like the mix of the technology, and I had an incredible time watching it, and it was like the opposite of, so last season they did the What If, what year was
1492.
Yeah, something like that.
That was actually our most contentious. What If the Avengers Assembled in 1602? That was 1602, our most.
Yeah.
That was our most contentious, because you really didn't like that, but I fucking loved that one.
Yeah.
Because they had everybody there, like everybody that was doing a voice. That was the person that was supposed to be the voice.
Yeah.
Was literally in that episode.
Which was cool. I just didn't, for whatever reason, it just didn't connect with me. And this absolutely did, man. I couldn't believe how much I enjoyed it. And it was perfect having Shang-Chi be the protagonist. Like, he just worked. Like, all of it. Like, hold my hat.
And then Haley Steinfeld coming in like an MVP playing Big Fish.
So, that cut to her when he says something that is, and he calls her Hawkeye, and then for that split second, think, oh, we're gonna get Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye, and it's not; it's Kate Bishop, and it's perfect, man. It was such a good episode.
It really, really was. I do. Okay, so the one thing that I felt like they rope-a-dope me on was, I honestly thought the Hood was gonna be Doctor Doom. Because of the references to Reed, because they had at least 5 references to Reed Richards in this show. And the fact that they didn't have him, okay, fine. But you say the Hood, and you knew that Dr. Doom was going to be coming around. You just didn't know where. It felt like because it becomes his sister, kind of felt like a cop-out to me, because I was like, I was like, oh shit, the Hood. And the way that the face looked, I'm like, oh, that's Dr. Doom. That has to be Doctor. We're going to get a Dr. Doom in this. Not at all. I'm sorry. But this one ends with a popper, because it ends with the Watcher being taken by the Eminence, because he's fucked around one too many times.
Yeah, voiced by Jason Isaacs.
But the best part of What If the Watcher Disappeared was it's the credit sequence, like we were talking about. It starts with him, and it's a very different, it's almost like Vision-esque in the way that he discusses the worlds. It's wild. That was my favorite part of this episode, was that I was not expecting him to take over, but it absolutely, the way that this show works, it absolutely makes sense, right?
Yeah. I really like that they played around with that. And this episode, I mean, we get Captain Carter, we get Corey, we get Godstorm,
Godstorm.
Yeah, she's just, and Birdie, who, voiced by Natasha Lyonne, who you come to understand is that's the egg from episode where she is the daughter of Howard the Duck and Darcy, the ducks, the ducks.
The ducks.
So funny.
What's his name? Fury calling them Mr. and Mrs. the Ducks. Was great in that other episode. So right off the bat, I do have a question for you. So perfect casting, right? You get it makes sense that it would be Natasha Lyonne that would be Seth Green.
If you took Seth Green's voice, like for Howard, that kind of New York thing he's doing, and then what's her name's voice for Darcy, and put them into this mixer, and we're like, they have a kid, what would she sound like? 100% she would sound like Natasha Lyonne.
Jaleon, 100%. No if, ands, or buts about it.
That's absolute spot on. Exactly what a child raised by them would sound like.
100%. So I have a question for you now, because we might as well get into this before we get into the rest of these two episodes, because the other one is what if, and they're basically a two-parter, one together.
Yeah, it really is a two-parter.
Yeah, we're not gonna do the next one. We'll just kind of talk about them together. But my big question to you is Natasha Lyonne playing two separate roles now, or did we just get a reveal that she's literally going to be playing Birdie?
Yeah, I don't know, man.
Because they do mention Reed Richards in this very prominently.
If the show What If winds up being this catalyst to Fantastic Four, that's gonna be wild,
right? And they have said, I've read the interviews with AC Bradley and Brian Andrews, like who are the showrunners for this whole entire thing, they have said that the reason why we've gotten these so quickly in this era is because they are a part of the MCU Phase 5. So these are a part of these are canonical and a part of the multiverse. And what's wild to me is that I know, like, we know LaDasha Leon has been, like, they even said it. They said, like, she has been cast in a already determined role, but they didn't tell us what the role was.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, are they, like, if it is, if she's playing this role, like, that's fucking wild.
Yeah.
That's, like, literally, that is the wildest thing that could possibly come out of Fantastic Four, right? Like, I don't even think, like, and we haven't seen anything of her on set, but the way they draw her makes it absolutely easy for them to not do anything other than mocap, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't even seen, like I said, we haven't seen her on set. We don't know what, I mean, hell, she could be what's the robot's name? Or did Ricky Gervais get cast for that?
Oh, I don't know. Herbie?
Herbie, yeah. Maybe Ricky Gervais got cast as that. Because I know that Ricky Gervais is playing a character, but I think that he might be cast as that. So, I mean, she could also be playing, what's her name?
I think we talked about her being Alicia Masters.
Yes, that's right. Alicia Masters.
So, it just, the ramifications of, like, finding out that all of Fantastic Four is just the What If movie, and it's just they're existing in a different timeline, which, you know, we've talked about, like, is that what's going to happen? Like, that's, mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's exciting. Like, it opens up doors for other things. Yeah, I don't know. I think she does a great job here.
Yeah, she does.
She's having a lot of fun. She's leaning into the zaniness, which she's generally good at too. Mm-hmm. She has less to do in the second part, like, but the finale, what if, like, really is like a prolonged fight scene. Like, it's almost 20 minutes of them, like, fighting.
Yeah, no, it is. Like, that's why it's a two-parter, right? Like, it sets up the team and the problem, and then the finale is just all fight. I really wish that they had released these together and not apart, because it does feel like the to be continued is like, oh, you sons of bitches.
Yeah, but only having to wait a day is a lot different than waiting a week.
Yeah. No, absolutely. But, like, what I do like about it is, like, it's a team, and they very much so made it a like an all female team, right? With Captain Carter being the lead, Powdery, Birdie,
going,
and then Storm.
Disney's going woke.
but got a bunch of
women coming in to save a man.
I know, like, which, like, you know, I find hilarious. Yeah,
it's pretty great. Like, watching them, like, kick ass, it's just, like, it is kind of this thing of where it's like, man, it would be great to have this stuff in live action. I'm glad we have it regardless, but, mm-hmm. it's freaking fantastic. Shame we're not going to get any more, man.
Really? Like, that's the thing is that this is my theory, is the way that it ends with the Watcher saying what he says, I feel like they left the door, closed the door, but they didn't lock it, which means is that I almost think, like, so these three seasons represent some of the best, like, Marvel writing in a long time on doing it purposely, like, it's weird because, like, these three seasons feel like phases.
Like, there are dark stuff. There's dark stuff. There's stuff that doesn't work as well, but it's fun. It's always still just fun. And before, like, with a few outliers, like Guardians 3, like, mm-hmm. that's something Marvel had lost. Like,
yeah,
Deadpool, Wolverine, you know, it's, yes, it's a Marvel thing, but it's bringing in something outside of that, but it's having fun. And like, I feel really hopeful that that's where we're headed. Like with the Marvel stuff, it's just back to having fun. And I mean, we'll find out in what, 6 weeks or so, with Captain America. It does like keep my hopes up really, really high for Marvel, like Marvel and Star Wars, and DC, like,
yeah,
ending the year really, really, really strong. Because we didn't talk about Creature Commandos. About it next week. But the show continues to be incredibly strong. So
yes, and risk taking in a lot of ways. Like, the Weasel episode broke me, man.
Yeah.
Like, I will say that much. Like, that was like just like heartbreaking in a way that only James Gunn can do. Heartbreaking. But you are right. Like, I mean, we haven't even talked, we'll probably talk more.
We'll definitely get into Skeleton Crew and Creature Commandos next week.
Yeah.
We'll have a lot. I feel like next week we're going to have a lot. So if you do want to hear me talk about, that's a good segue into plugging it. If you do want to hear me talk about Skeleton Crew and you don't want to wait on this podcast, we did just record an episode about this week's episode, which you can find over at xwingfiles.com, where you can find this podcast and all the other podcasts that we do. We break the episode down, talk about how much fun it was and like what some of the things that we saw might mean. Because boy, we saw some stuff I didn't think we'd see. Me and Adam will definitely talk about it more next week. Go check out all that stuff at xwingfiles.com. Go rate and review us on iTunes, and you can go find our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieisle.com, where we are in the midst of, I just posted something. It was a box set of the Road movies by Hope and Crosby. And if you know anything about that, that's actually pretty exciting that we actually got a box set of these movies in Blu-ray. All of them, all seven of them. They may be culturally inappropriate nowadays because of some of the stuff that they do there. But I will tell you, I had a lot of fun with these. I had a lot of fun writing about these and just kind of rediscovering them and just forgetting about the fact that, you always think that Bing Crosby is the superstar, but realistically, when you rewatch them and you see that it's it's Bob Hope that's like, and you watch the special features, you realize Bob Hope is the superstar. It's actually Bing Crosby that they're helping lift up into movies, and he was just more of the song guy. That was a lot of fun to actually like go in and deep dive into these seven movies and watch them multiple times to review and stuff. So there's that. I keep on like, I'm sorry guys, I assure you Logan's final push to the 50 is coming. I this week I've been sick, so I will be getting to that in the new year and starting off the new year right with Moving Pictures. So we got that also on the site, themovieisle.com.
For the record, I have not pressured him about it at all. I'm just he'll let me know when he's got him on the back end of the site. And like, I am not in a rush. So you're not. Because I still have at least one more to deliver. Plus, yeah. I have to sit down. I was going to do it this past weekend. I didn't freaking do it. Sit down and compile a list of all the films I watched and try to do my annual, like, here's all. I might do it a little bit different. Thinking about just discussing the superhero stuff because I watched a lot of superhero stuff and kind of just like going at it that way rather than all the films I watched. I don't know. I haven't decided. But yeah, I've got, I'm going to work on this week compiling the list. That way it's not like the end of February when I give you like, here's my thoughts on all the stuff that I watched last year.
No, absolutely. Like that sounds like a lot of fun. Like, and there was enough. I mean, there was a lot. There was a shit ton of superhero stuff that we saw that was themed this year. And I mean, like movies alone, yeah. But I mean, movies and TV, that's kind of like bread and butter, right? So yeah, I'll have my top up. If you all follow me on Letterboxd, you can actually see my top list right now. It wouldn't be a surprise. I have a couple of other movies that I want to see. That are probably not going to change anything.
I was just disappointed Madam Web wasn't on the list at all.
if I do a worst of list, that will be the best worst of. Like, honestly, because I think I've seen it like 3 times. And it doesn't get any better. It stays the same for me. It doesn't get any better. But, man, like, I get more and more questions about that.
It's so incredibly stupid. It's so much fun. It's just
it
so
really
dumb.
Is. It really is. Adam Scott should not be allowed to work in movies anymore after being in that movie. Him and Dakota Johnson both.
Like, I look at that and I'm just like, are they terrible actors?
They're terrible.
I mean, the dialogue is certainly terrible, but like, anyway, go check out all that stuff. We'll be back next week talking about definitely Skeleton Crew and Creature Commandos and whatever else we happen to watch or any news that might break. So we'll see you guys then. Number 4, Mario. Number 5, Weird Al. Number 6, Batman. Number 7, Kal-El. Number 8, Simpsons. Number 9, TV. Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s. But before they all sold out, see it all together if you're with me now.